This week on Pirate Party Radio, Canadian government pays company to secretly spread propaganda. New British government vowed to repeal part of Digital Economy Act, and the three strikes rule go into effect in Ireland. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 30 for Thursday, May 27th, 2010.
So really, the most important thing I advise people when using something like Facebook is understand that there is really no way to guarantee that whatever you do there is going to remain private. And so, you know, even though we want to do pretty personal communications, I think we need to do so with the expectation that that will someday become public and searchable on the internet.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last controls. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories I mentioned during the show. And off the top of the show, there's an intro clip, and this was from a talk about online piracy. Privacy on NPR's Science Friday, sent in by LC, and that was just a little clip from one of the panel that they were talking to. We've got a bunch of incoming messages here. This first one's from Darklight. Your last episode blew my mind. We spend half the last episode of GSS, a Great Southern Stand, that's a radio show that this person is on, discussing your comments about the artists claiming cash long after the work is done. You're dead right. Who else does that? If I tried to claim a percentage of the tourist dollars because my ancient ancestors helped build Stonehenge, I'd be locked up, and quite rightly too. Very astute stuff, man. Keep up the awesome work, dude. Still a pleasure to be involved. Well, thank you very much, Darklight, from Great Southern Stand Radio Show. This next one's from Deset. Two comments / questions for you. I was wondering what your thoughts on a right to privacy, on a right to privacy and anonymity as a basic inherent right being added to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really give you a great impression, interpretation of what we already have in what is Section 8 of our Canadian Charter, which says everyone has the right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizure, which I would think would encompass search and seizure of our digital self as well as our personal self. How that goes into effect when you are searched, your laptop or your computers are searched, or your digital online version of yourself is searched and not even searched, but let loose in a way that you don't really want it let loose onto the on the internet, but this is specifically for the government, that part of it. And we also have the Privacy Act, which deals with the government's handling of our personal information, and the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act, which deals with companies dealing with our private data. So you'll have to look into those things on how far they go in terms of saying how much your data is being protected. So I think we do need extremely strong privacy laws in Canada and the rest of the world. Your data should belong to you and you only. But how those are interpreted and how well the companies obey them to begin with, because once your private data is released onto the internet, it's there forever, effectively, I mean, maybe that data will go away because nobody's mirrored it, but you have to assume that it's going to be there forever because it can be there forever, especially if it's in a big database that's passed around from company to company. And how are you even able to know where your own data is being stored? If it's in some random company you've never heard of, how are you supposed to get that information back? Is there a way to submit your name and data, a request for your data to be searched on all the company's databases in the world, even ones outside of the jurisdiction of your country? Probably not. There's probably countries out there that don't, you know, there are countries out there that don't have, you know, a good relationship with the country that you're in. And they could be used as offshore data havens for private information from citizens. So it's really up to you to keep your data safe and not rely upon the laws of the land and the laws of the government and even the outlines of corporations, what they say they're going to do with your data. You can't guarantee that's going to not change in the future, as in the case of Facebook, because once they say something to begin with, they can change their terms of service, and maybe you haven't used it in a while and you haven't deactivated your account or deleted all that data, and you just, it's been sitting there on Facebook and they've changed and updated their terms of service. And of course, in the terms of service, they can change their terms of service anytime. So they set up a company, please give us all your data, it's totally protected. And then the next day they go, no, none of it's protected, we changed our terms of service because we said we can. And you have no clue that they have changed it. The second part of his question, as well your comments on the Quebec law being put in place that would be required for Muslim women to show their face while receiving government services, essentially violating their right to freedom of religion by not wearing their traditional dress. Well, obviously, it's a very touchy subject for a lot of people. Now, if you can define to me what constitutes a religion, then I can answer that question properly in terms of violating that freedom of religion. Because freedom of religion does not mean that the rules of the religion overrule the law of the land. As an extreme example, some religions demand ritual sacrifices to their gods. Yes, these are very oft not practiced religions anymore, but there are religions out there that have that. So sanctioned murder by your religion does not overrule the law of the land, because because you claim that murder is part of my religion, doesn't matter what religion it is, because you have to define what a religion is first, doesn't mean it overrules the murder laws of the country that you're in. Otherwise, everybody would just be making up their own religions, making up all the rules of their religion, and overruling the law of the lands by saying, this is my religion. And how are you going to define religion? Oh, it has to be around for X number of years. No, there's very loosely defined terms of religion. Is it terms of how many people are part of that religion? Well, then they could just declare large groups of people a religion, and they can dictate things that would overrule the law of the land. So it's kind of a sticky situation there. Now, either the law needs to be changed, or you will have to face the possible consequences of breaking that law. So if somebody doesn't like the anonymity that they have to break, or not the anonymity, but break the rules of their religion, then they have to fight to change the laws of the land so it corresponds to their religion. And there's plenty of examples of religious rule in other countries. And if the government services depend upon breaking anonymity and receiving positive identification, then the question of anonymity is out the door, because you have to identify yourself to be able to receive these certain services. Because how can somebody anonymously ask for government money, walk out the door, and then come back in and again say, I would like more money, in terms of like employment insurance, where, you know, you get a certain amount every month. And if you can't identify yourself positively, saying, I am this person, then how are you supposed to be able to get those government services? Of course, for anonymous government services, say you want a tax form, they've got a pile of tax forms. You don't have to identify yourself to get a tax form, but you will have to identify yourself when sending in a tax form. But for paying your taxes. That's just an example. There are plenty of other services that you can receive anonymous services from the government without identifying yourself. And there are plenty of examples where you have to identify yourself to receive these services. So the system breaks down if there is no positive identification of this person. Now, this doesn't have to break the rules of the religion if they can't show their face. Maybe there are other forms of showing positive identification of a person, say by a signature, say by even extreme example of matching your DNA on a database of the government. Now, very few people would like to go to this extreme of having the government having a full DNA database of everyone in their country. But that is just an example of how you can identify yourself without breaking these rules. So, anonymity, absolute anonymity, and personalized government services are completely incompatible. They can't coexist. Personalized government services, because you can't be personalized and be anonymous at the same time. So, certain government services will not be available to people if they wish to remain anonymous. Now, I am very strongly in favor of anonymity because backlash can occur when anonymity is broken, when you're trying to get information out that otherwise you wouldn't put out if you were not anonymous in the terms of whistleblowers or unpopular speech. Not illegal speech, but unpopular speech where there can be backlashes against the person speaking out, yet they need to get this information out. So there's my answer to you. Mind Inversion sends in an article titled The Privacy Machiavellis About Facebook and Google Knowing So Much About You. And I'll link to that article. I won't go over it because it really doesn't represent much news. But he says, Mind Inversion says, the one thing that bothers me about this is that not that it's inevitable that online tracking and targeting ads are going to happen, but that everyone avoids completely whether or not things should be okay. I wonder if it's possible to copyright one's personal information. That way, not only can I use the DMCA to easily remove my information from the web, I could also go after huge statutory damages from people who have been illegally profiting from my data. I think $5,000 per instance should about do it. Yeah, I know, but it's still a nice thought. Yeah, it would be nice if we could have this elevated status of person that corporations enjoy without all the downfalls of not acting like a real person. Well, the most important thing we need, regardless of what laws are in place to protect you, is more education about when you should or shouldn't be sharing your personal information. You should assume at all times, if you're entering something into a website, that it's going to be public information. Now, of course, there are caveats to this. When you're trying to buy something online, you can't put cash into your computer and it comes out the other end and have no tracking information in terms of your address, your name. You could use a fake name if you could put cash into the computer, but you can't. You have to sign up with online services to coordinate cash transfers between your bank or your credit card to this other person. So it's very difficult to do online stuff and anonymous that way. But if you're not doing that, there's certain levels of anonymity that could be enacted on the internet using open Wi-Fi, changing your MAC addresses, keeping on the move, stuff like that. We also need to let people know how companies are trying to data mine you. In addition to, you know, educating people about not putting personal information on the web. You have to assume that everything is public. And the fallout that can be from these companies data mining you with all this data. That can have an effect on your personal, financial, and employable life. And you'll see later in a story that I'm going to talk about how Facebook privacy can ruin your career, or lack of Facebook privacy can ruin your career, your financial gain, and being able to keep employed. And keeping your privacy is a very important thing. People always tout out how, oh, it doesn't matter what I put in Facebook. It really will have no effect on me. I mean, people don't look at that. It's a huge sea of people. People will never be able to find out stuff about me. There's just too many people on Facebook. Well, you'll see later that is not completely true. We've got a lot of news to get through, so here we go. Copyright news from Ireland. Irish ISP and major music labels ready to disconnect pirates. It is happening. It has started. Send in by Mind Inversion. After more than a year of wrangling both in and out of court, EMI, Sony, Universal, Warner, and ISP Earcom, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, finally have a deal ready to fly. Shortly, the labels will start supplying the IP addresses of alleged file sharers to Earcom, so that it may punish them. The most stubborn subscribers will be disconnected from the internet for a year. In February 2009, IRMA, representing EMI, Sony, Universal, and Warner, reached an out-of-court settlement with Ireland's largest ISP, Iacom. The deal would see the ISP introduce a three-strike system for dealing with subscribers who share songs to which the labels own the copyright. The implementation of the agreement was held up over legal argument, but last month, the High Court of Dublin gave the green light. It is completely within the legitimate standing of Iacom to act and to be seen to act as a body which upholds the law and constitution, wrote Justice Charlton. This is what the court expects of both individuals and companies. Dick Doyle, Director General of IRMA, subsequently announced that his group and Iacom would implement the fully agreement, and today that process begins for the ISP's 750,000 broadband customers. IRMA will now begin supplying Iacom with IP addresses that anti-piracy company DTechNet believes are connected to infringements. According to the Irish Times, initial IRMA will supply just 50 IP addresses per week, with a review of the scheme being carried out after 3 months. So that is a couple thousand people. Those caught up in the sweep will first be telephoned by Iacom with a verbal warning. Don't do that. If the same customer receives a third warning, a 7-day ban will come into force. A fourth warning will see their broadband disconnected for a year. So it's three strikes and then another fourth strike. Doyle says researchers suggest that 80% of the people would stop file sharing after receiving an ISP warning them of the consequences. Next month, Iacom rival UPC will be up in a court over its resistance to implement a similar deal with IRMA, and many are wishing the ISP well in its battle. So, hopefully in Ireland, people have the choice of which ISP to go through and are able to educate themselves on what is happening with their current ISP and make the choice to maybe change ISPs based on their habits and what they're doing with their customers and how they're, you know, spying in on their customers and tracking them and making sure they're being the good corporate citizens that they are and agreeing with the EMI, Sony, Universal, and Warner. And because they reached it out of court, they were not taken to court over this. They are in full agreement with these corporations, and were not forced to do this. They were monetarily forced to do this. So I guess they don't really worry about losing too many customers over this. And as a follow-up to this story, Pirate Bay blasts Irish three strikes ISP, sent in by Playton. Swedish BitTorrent tracker site refers to Iacom as Failcom and encourages customers subscribe to VPN services such as its own iPredator. Yesterday, I mentioned how this is the person talking in the article. I mentioned how Ireland's largest ISP, Iricom, has formally begun disconnecting repeat accused file shares from the internet, making it the first European country to have a three-strikes graduated response system. The move was a voluntary effort to settle a lawsuit filed against it by the Irish Recorded Music Association, IRMA, which was trying to hold the ISP responsible for illegal file sharing by its customers. How they're able to hold the ISP responsible for what its customers are doing is beyond me. Being able to track every single thing against some sort of massive database saying, yeah, this is a bad thing to do, this is a good thing to do, and, you know, coming down as the police of the internet is just not the right approach to keeping the internet the way it should be. It should be a more open type of internet rather than this police lockdown firewalled thing that really goes against what it was set up for. It was set up for the free exchange of ideas between nodes. Justice Peter Charleston approved the settlement on the condition that the music industry would also target IRCOM's competitors to avoid giving other ISPs an unfair competitive advantage. So the courts in Ireland said, okay, you can go after the customers, but as long as you go after the customers as well of other ISPs. I think that's a fair way of doing things. So if you're going to enact something like this, you should enact it all over the place and not just target the one person, but, you know, come down hard on customers everywhere for alleged file sharing without going through due process, without going to court, just on, you know, corporations sending in an IP address and maybe a name of some MP3 or AVI and saying, yeah, this person did it. Oh, yeah, for sure. Please kick them off the internet. Put the fear into their hearts and get rid of them. Could you please as well lose money from this customer as well? We don't have to pay a dime. We'll just send you this electronic piece of paper so you can lose all your customers. Is that okay? Well, the court sanctioned it, so we're going to go ahead with that. Many file sharers, if not choosing the simple option of merely switching ISP, will surely turn to other non-detectable peer-to-peer methods such as VPNs and Usenet, to name a few. It's the former, VPNs, that is worth noting because it's a rather inexpensive means of circumventing detection methods. In fact, Swedish BitTorrent tracker the Pirate Bay is reminding IRCOM customers that its VPN is ready and willing to help them in their time of need. iPredator Hearts Ireland read the homepage earlier today. Pound Failcom introduced Orwellian laws. Hide yourself. Exactly right. It's not their business what you are doing over the internet with your ones and zero bits of data. Go for it. Hide yourself. Your protection and your privacy is your business. What you're talking about and transferring between your bank, your friends, a website, anything else is not the business of the RIA, MPAA, or anyone else. It is the business between you and that other end website. It is bits of data. It is nothing for you to be concerned about. Please move on. Thank you. So, people of Ireland, there are your solutions for these draconian measures of censorship and monitoring. There are options for you. Now, it is not free, this VPN that people are offering, so there are options out there. You should seek out and see what is available to you. In copyright news, Giga News lawyer says Steal This Film is an illegal download sent in by Playton. This is the ignorance that is showing through, the confusion that is showing through to everyone out there, because everyone is scared. Scared silly of these corporations that are coming down saying everything's copyrighted, it's all ours, the internet, we own you. We own your bits, we own your data, we own what you post, we own it all. You have to run it through our scanners, our detectors, and make sure that, you know, you're allowed to post it on the internet. because, you know, everything's copyrighted by special people in high places with lots of money and lots of lawyers. As the once minority activity of downloading from newsgroups enters the mainstream, the ever more aggressive copyright-related lawsuits are doing likewise. In this environment, Usenet-related companies are becoming increasingly careful to keep their behaviors entirely legal. Leading Usenet provider GigaNews has taken the concept to a whole new level. After many years in the shadows, Usenet has been grabbing a share of copyright-related headlines during the last year. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, there's this company. Let me just skip down. At the folks over at Unzbin, unzbin.com, have been beavering away in recent months to make an NZB client, or NZB, in the States, that they hope will become the uTorrent of the newsgroups. Unzbin client is very compact, and since receiving a great review at the start of April, have been refining it further still. But unfortunately, they've had a little problem in recent days. I just installed this after reading this story, and it is an amazing client for interfacing and downloading binary information from newsgroups. It's excellent way of distribution. It acts very much like a torrent client, which people are used to. I'll continue on. At the end of March, Unzbin opened an affiliate account with GigaNews, one of the world's leading Usenet providers. Everything ran fine until a couple of days ago when Unzbin received an email warning not from the MPAA, but from GigaNews. This letter shall serve a written notice that you are in material breach of GigaNews Terms and Conditions Agreement you entered in March 31st, 2010. In Section 3.2 of the agreement, you represented and warranted that your website would not contain, display, or any other way communicate any inappropriate or illegal information as determined by GigaNews in its sole and unfettered discretion. The webpage is located at URL and URL. Instructions on how to illegally downloaded copyright material, which is inappropriate or illegal information. So, etc., etc. They said that they showed people how to download illegal or inappropriate or copyrighted material. In this case, they thought it was copyrighted material. Sincerely, Office of the General Counsel, GigaNews. Not a Unzbin then. Sadly, not even close. Here is the copyright infringing screenshot in question. And they give a screenshot, and it shows them downloading two specific files. The first file is labeled Steal This Film, and the second file is labeled Ubuntu. It says, free and legal to download movie, check. Free and legal to download software, check. Clearly, there's been some sort of mistake then. Apparently not. Unzbin later received a more personal email from a GigaNews affiliate manager who explained the problem in more detail, but only succeeding in creating more confusion. Regarding the notice that was just sent to you, there's only one concern on your site, which is the prominence of the example, Steal This Film, in various screenshots of the program being used on the site. As you know, we can't control and monitor everything that is uploaded to Usenet. We also don't advertise the potential attainability of copyrighted materials and ask the same for all affiliates. We do know that Steal This Film is a free documentary about file sharing and intellectual property, but most people, and to legal entities, it will appear as instructional usage of your software. The Ubuntu example is perfect. I think that is more than adequate in getting the point of Unzbin functionality. To say the least, Unzbin is very unimpressed with GigaNews and expressed this clearly in their response. As you know, Steal This Film is a documentary which is freely available. We're not going to remove anything from our website, and frankly, I don't understand why GigaNews is meddling into our internal affairs. We run our project the way we want, and that's how it's going to be. I think it's a very bold and hypocritical move on your part, and so we're going to discontinue working with you guys, simply because we do believe in freedom of speech and freedom of expression. We have no tolerance for Nazi Gestapo practices and threats, which don't impress or scare me one bit. Kind regards, and a big fuck you. Unzbin. This is the second time I recall that someone has been stupid enough to miss the joke of Steal This Film. That you can't steal something that has been offered to you willingly. Jamie King, creator of Steal This Film, told Torrent Freak. It kind of strains the credulity that anyone could be so dumb, but there it is. Obviously, we're delighted Unzbin offers Steal This Film as a download example, and doing so clearly doesn't violate GigaNews' policies. Asking for them to cease and desist amounts to nothing less than a freedom of speech violation, he concludes. Torrent Freak wrote GigaNews twice asking for a comment, but we received no response, which is a real shame, but not really a surprise. Putting a foot put wrongly in today's copyright climate could cost Giga News an absolute fortune, perhaps even their entire business, so it is to be expected that they choose to err on the side of caution. So there it is, all laid out for you. Privacy news from the U.S. I mean, people are just so afraid. The fear. I mean, last week I reported that the campaign that they're going to use against everybody is fear. They can't win in courts. They've seceded that last week, I told you. They said they're going to win the war on propaganda. And this is an example of how they're winning the war. That people are so afraid of these corporations that have conglomerated and own the collective mind share of music and movies that people are so afraid that they won't stand up for even the best example out there called Steal This Film that is completely free to download and free to distribute, that they're so scared that they will not even touch it with a 10-foot pole. So good on Unspin for standing up for freedom that we already have, that is still available to us, that we're able to still make our own videos in this realm called the internet that has not been locked down and walled off like a garden that we're not allowed into unless we purchase the ticket for the ride, if we're tall enough. Privacy news from the U.S. Understanding the latest Facebook privacy train wreck. Yes, another Facebook news story. I'm sorry. But they're one of the most perfect examples of privacy. And I like using the Facebook example of why privacy is so important and why people should be concerned about it. This is sent in by DC. Facebook's latest privacy problem should raise a few eyebrows. Now, I didn't hear about this one, so maybe some people out there also didn't hear about it. Facebook sharing private data in unexpected and occasionally unwelcome ways is nothing new. But this newest problem is unusual in that it does something that Facebook's lengthy and oft-updated privacy policy explicitly said should not happen. It shares private user information with advertisers. The research originally describing the process looked at more than just Facebook. Many social networking sites, including LinkedIn, Dig, and Twitter, suffer the same leakage of personal data. Of the 12 sites looked at by the research, the only one that didn't leak data at advertisers was the one already owned by the advertising company, Orkut. The private information was leaked out to advertisers in a couple of ways. The most widespread problem was the HTTP referrer. In general, every time a web browser requests a page from a web server, it sends the web server of the URL of the current web page, the referrer, in addition to the name of the new page. This information is used for a number of purposes. It's useful for website owners as it allows them to know, for example, which search engines are providing most of their traffic and which internal links within the site are being followed and by implication which aren't. This lets site owners know which parts of their design are useful and the kind of communities that are interested in their content, the search terms that people are using to find their pages and so on. So it's very, very useful to know where people are coming from and how they're getting to your site. It's extremely useful for tracking who's coming in. Another popular usage scenario is to block certain requests if the referral comes from a different domain to prevent bandwidth leeching. For example, if an email goes on and says it, if a web server sees a request for an image, but the HTTP refers to a different site, indicating that the image has been linked or embedded on somebody else's web page, it can block the request. Generally, this information is harmless because usually the referring URL is not personally identifying. That's because most URLs aren't customized for individual users. Everyone performing the same search in Google will get the same URL for the result page. Everyone visiting a page here from Ars will visit the same URL and so on. The problem this causes with social networking sites is that often the referring URL does contain identifying information, such as the ID or username. This makes sense. The entire point of these sites is that they're personalized and contain user-specific data, but means that referring URLs become a whole lot more valuable. So really, it's about the way transferring data from the specific customized URL for you that's being passed on to third-party websites when you're clicking ads or clicking links. Now, there are many ways to get around this, such as cookies that don't display what page you're looking on. Say you're looking at your own profile. This is the concern, is that you're looking at your profile page, an ad comes up on the side that is very relevant to you, and you want to click on it and go look at it and go, oh, that looks like something I'd want to buy. And you click on it, and you go to the advertiser's page. But what comes along with it is the URL of your Facebook site. It has identifying information about specifically you that the advertiser didn't have before. This is extremely important to note, that now they have more information that they ever had before, and they can put that in their databases along with the IP address. They know exactly who you are now. Before, they just knew you as a number. Now they know your exact name, even if you don't order anything from you. Now imagine, okay, this is Facebook. This is just Facebook. Now imagine if this was a website such as a banking website, and they put your bank information in the URL, like your credit card number or your bank number, and you click to another page, and this other page gets all that information because it's in the URL. And people would decry it. Bad move. What's going on? Why isn't the bank keeping my information private? Well, they do. The banks do that. They don't put your banking information in the URL. And why isn't Facebook doing it? Well, they did immediately after they were contacted, but they haven't been for the longest time. I'm trying to find where it says that. One claim does look to have some merit. Facebook was probably leaking information to advertisers, but doesn't seem to be anymore. The Wall Street Journal's writers contacted Facebook and state that the company acknowledged the potential for leakage and has taken protective measures in response. So it's very important that people keep on top of these companies and their privacy with these companies, that they don't pass on personal information and how long have they been doing this? And how much information is out there that has been passed on to advertisers that you don't know about? It's extremely distressing how much data leakage is occurring without these people even knowing it, and how many people use these hundreds of millions of people use Facebook, and now all this information is leaking out of their site. And we trust them with our information. We should trust them, but we can't trust them. The CEO of Facebook can't even trust himself with Facebook, because long time ago I mentioned that his pictures even got leaked out, and he quickly covered them up. He can't even keep his own data safe. Privacy news from the UK. New UK government to curb CCTV, scrap ID cards, and help open source. So this is privacy and open source. A whole bunch of stuff is falling under this, done by DC. Now this is promises. We'll see if this is actually followed through. The Britain of today is watched constantly by CCTV cameras, is preparing for a national ID card, slaps a crown copyright on most government data, and can now censor websites and eventually boot people off the internet. According to the new Liberal Democrat Tory coalition government, that's all about to change. The coalition today released its unified policy statement for techies and privacy advocates. There's a lot to like. It says, we will scrap the ID card scheme, the National Identity Register, and the contact point database, and halt the next generation of biometric passports. Yay. We will outlaw the fingerprinting of children at school without parental permission. We will adopt the protections of the Scottish model for the DNA database. I don't know what that is. Obviously, it's a good thing. I haven't looked into what the Scottish model of the DNA database. I guess that, hopefully, that is the DNA database when people are convicted of a crime and not just arrested for a crime or suspect of a crime, but actually declared that they actually did the crime. And if you are arrested and your DNA is taken, hopefully it's exorcised from the database. We will review, but I don't know if that's a Scottish model. I'm hoping that is. We will review libel laws to protect freedom of speech, because I know the libel laws are very crazy over there in Britain. We will further regulate CCTV. We will end the storage of internet and email records without good reason. We will create a level playing field for open source software, and we will enable large ICT projects to be split into smaller components. We will create a new right to data so that the government-held datasets can be requested and used by the public and then published on a regular basis. We will introduce measures to ensure the rapid rollout of super-fast broadband across the country. We will ensure that BT, British Telecom, and other infrastructure providers allow the use of their assets to deliver such broadband, and we will seek to introduce super-fast broadband in remote areas at the same time as in more populated ones. If necessary, we will consider using the part of the TV licensing fee that is supporting the digital switchover to fund broadband in area that the market alone will not reach. Wow, that is a big set of advances, or, you know, taking back of what they've already implemented and, you know, making society better rather than making it worse. Now, these are promises, but they were announced after the government has been elected, so hopefully these are sincere and they're actually going to be put forward and enacted. And they sound great. I don't know how people would want to oppose any of those. It's more freedom for the people, more privacy for the people, more protection for the people, and a more open government. It's good all around. And you have to applaud the little bit of good that goes on when you can, and decry the bad when it comes out and show attention to it. But you also have to report good stuff, too. Copyright news from the U.S. Details of the rapid share decision. No search engine plus efforts to take down copyright material helped. So this is good news as well. Early we wrote about is sent by Random Hero. Early we wrote about the ruling against Perfect 10 and its attempt to get temporary restraining order in RapidShare. As we mentioned at the time, the only details we had were based on RapidShare's press release that blah, blah, blah. From the initial statements about the ruling from RapidShare saying that it could not be infringing since it was just the host, I'd naturally assume that the court found RapidShare was protected by the DMCA's safe harbors. It's like a takedown. You respond to DMCA requests, blah, blah, blah. But this is not the case. In fact, the court basically tosses out RapidShare's safe harbor claim. Because RapidShare bizarrely had never set up an official DMCA agent, which is necessary to qualify for safe harbors. I would guess that RapidShare's excuse for not doing so is not based in the US, which makes sense. Why would you follow US rules if you're not in the US? But it's going to deal with lawsuits in the US. It's crazy not to have set up a DMCA agent. That said, there are some interesting things, not all good, in the ruling. There are a few things that helped RapidShare here. First, that it does do the takedown content it believes to be infringing. Second, and perhaps most interesting, is the fact that it does not index or promote content stored on a service by itself. Since most file sharing services include a search engine aspect, the court concludes that this is a key element of suggesting that RapidShare is not liable for direct infringement. That's an interesting ruling that could have answered the question I've asked before, whether or not it actually is possible to create a site that allows for sharing of files that does not run afoul of the Grokster inducement rules. The other thing it helps RapidShare is that despite being involved in a whole bunch of copyright cases, it still appears that Perfect 10 is somewhat incompetent in understanding copyright law and availing itself of tools to deal with infringement. In this case, Perfect 10 didn't send RapidShare the specific links where infringing content existed. I remember that. They just sent a list of files saying, please take these down, and RapidShare had no way of finding where these files were. Where are these files? We don't know. We have a huge place. We have no way of looking for these. Please give us specifics. And so even then, RapidShare did try to find as many of the images as possible, even going so far as doing Google searches and deleting them. On top of that, RapidShare has a tool that lets content owners indicate if certain files are infringing. So if you find one, you click infringing, it'll be reported, but Perfect 10 chose not to do that. So, This is good. They were not found to be infringing. That is great. So it does show that there is a way that you can protect your content from sharing from one person to another and not get that site taken down, you can actually run a site without worrying that some file is going to land on your site and you're going to be taken into court for something somebody else did. This is a great advancement, and hopefully this will stand up to the test of time, that third parties should not be responsible for infringements that people enact upon them. Like, how is Google supposed to react to all the things that are indexed by them? They're not responsible for that. RapidShare is not responsible for something somebody uploaded. If you can report that, great, it gets taken down. That is the best method we have so far. Here's a story. Here's a little insight into the other side. The other side, the content owner's mind, and how they think in terms of copyright. Copyright news from the U.S. News Corp flabbergasted anyone could oppose three strikes. Sent it by Mind Inversion. Rupert Murdoch's son, James, runs News Corp's sprawling operations in Europe and Asia, and he's had it with the search engines, consumer electronic companies, and users who want to access his company's content without paying a fair contribution. In a speech this week to University College London, home to Jeremy Bentham's bizarre auto icon, I don't know what that is, where Murdoch oversaw the opening of a new central for digital humanities, he expressed his astonishment that anyone could object to such absolute ripping ideas as internet disconnections for copyright infringement, ripping being a good thing. Government should enforce basic property rights, even in this digital environment. He said, some have started. In some quarters, this has caused alarm. But what really is alarming is that it's controversial at all to shut down vast pirate sites or disconnect repeat offenders who have no regard for creators' rights. The Liberal Democrats, the Junior Coalition of Partners, and the new UK government are among those who don't support this approach to piracy. Given the good of copyright, Murdoch can't wonder why the forces of copyright skepticism are having such success. Moving beyond the utopian arguments and the rhetoric of freedom, he argues that the device makers and the search engines are the new parasites of the digital age. Take the search business, he said. It depends on the ability to index and search other people's material and present the results of those searches to its users surrounded by advertising. Search is a highly profitable business because the raw material presented to customers can be indexed at essentially zero incremental cost. Therefore, information that might only be searchable or indexed with a fair price paid to the producer undermines that model. Thus, when Google makes its arguments in favor of copyright limits or fair use or tries to push through its Google Book Search proposal, content creators see only an attempt to enrich itself. The same is true for device makers. Content owners, especially music labels, have long felt that device makers like Apple and Microsoft have reaped huge profits based on user infringements. Selling iPods at a couple $100 a piece has been great business for Apple. If those iPods are mainly filled with illicit copies, it's not such a great business for the labels. If device makers cared, surely they would do more. We should also consider consumer electronic companies and device makers, said Murdoch. Devices, however smart they look, however innovative they are lifeless without content. Manufacturers have a clear incentive to drive the cost of content towards zero in order to drive customers to buy their products without additional competition from rights holders for their customers' money. Ooh, these arguments are not really compelling. So, a company makes products that somebody wants and says, oh, these are great devices. They really help me listen to music. They really help me watch movies that I want to see. But I need to put some content on those. Let me go see if there is any content. Let's see if I can download some MP3s to put on here. No, there's no MP3s from, you know, all these big places. Well, oh, there's a site here with a whole bunch of MP3s. Oh, these are easy to play. Oh, I can transfer them from my computer to my portable device, to my car, to my phone. This is great. And they're all indexed and stuff, and they're pretty well organized. I have to search, and I don't know when things come out. They're not really announced very well. But, you know, I can find them. The problem is, with this attitude that Rupert Murdoch has, is that he's not looking at these devices as great advances in distribution of music and the availability of music and usability of music, he's seeing them as a disadvantage. He's seeing them as, oh, people are ripping us off. No, people want these things. People want to listen to your music. People want to watch your movies. And they want to use these devices to do it because they're good and they're easy and they're convenient. Why aren't you supplying the information to go on these easy devices, these convenient devices that you can transfer the data back and forth? Because you're stuck in the old way of doing things. You don't understand that people want convenience. They want to be able to look and hear things when they want it, not when you want it. You have to adapt with the times, or you're going to lose out. And you are losing out, because these companies are overtaking you. These companies are setting up new distribution models and new ways of hearing your music and movies. And soon, there will be no need for your music and movies. There will be other people's music and movies that are perfectly able to get on to these devices, and they don't need to go through the middlemen, which is all you are now. You're just an enabler, getting these overpaid actors and overpaid artists onto devices that are completely locked down, when there are millions of artists out there and millions of people with microphones and guitars and cameras pointing at things, making interesting music and movies that are soon going to be filling these devices, and they can ignore you and your ramblings of old. So there's no need for trying to decry this and trying to get these things shut down. And in terms of his search engine argument, it's ridiculous that it's too convenient. It's too easy to find things. It's the ripping off pages that are freely being given out. Well, if you don't want them indexed on Google, tell your robots.txt to not index you on Google, and they won't index you on Google, and you'll be left in the dust, and people will go to other news sites where they can get their news. And you won't have to supply news to Google because they don't really need you. I remember the days before good search engines. It was awful. It was incredibly hard to find things on the internet. I remember when Yahoo was not a crawling search engine, when people had to submit their websites. I had to submit my own website to Yahoo, find the category it fits under, because you search by category. If you wanted to look at music websites, you'd click in music, and then you click in, you know, rock music or punk music or whatever. And to be able to find the band you're looking for, it was awful. You had to hand submit websites, and half of them that were indexed were broken links because they didn't exist after 3 months, and they never cleaned them up. You had to report them and get it. It was awful. Search engines of now, people don't know how good they have it. Or maybe they do know how good they have it. Open government in Canada. Canadian government pays organization to troll political chat forums sent in by DC. The Canadian government has been caught paying a media group to monitor online political discussions and respond to misinformation. In other words, to spread state-sanctioned propaganda in their latest scandal to hit the Harper administration. Under the pilot program, the Harper government paid a media company $75,000 to monitor and respond to online postings about the East Coast seal hunt, reports News 1130. The government has a lot of power that it feels the need to monitor public bulletin boards or places where people express views and then respond to that, and it seems to be going beyond a reasonable action the government should be taking, said UBC computer science professor and president of the BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association, Richard Rosenberg. A poll carried on the News 1130 website showed that the majority of respondents, 77%, are not intimidated by the fact that the government is monitoring their online conversations and would not regulate the information they post on the internet. Accusations that people who defend the seemingly indefensible in the aftermath of government atrocities, wars, and scandals are in the pay of unscrupulous authorities circulate on a regular basis. But the fact that fact is that governments and transnational corporations have been making a habit of using the internet to spread propaganda by using individuals who pose as neutral observers. The innovator of these black propaganda techniques are undoubtedly Monsanto, who as far back as the late 90s were creating fake citizens via their PR front company Bivings to post messages on internet bulletin boards, lauding the virtues and scoffing the dangers of genetically modified food. In the 21st century, governments try to harness the power of manufacturing fake consensus in order to dictate reality and justify their actions. Well, this issue was posted in the Pirate Party Radio forums, this story, and I responded with this. I wrote this here. I definitely think that the government should be more involved in online discussions and possibly open a forum on their own website so people can provide feedback. It's good that they're paying attention to what people are saying online. If they are paying people to troll websites and forums, they should identify that they are working for the government so that they are not misidentified as concerned citizens. Now, there will always be disinformation from corporations, government, and even normal everyday citizens trying to persuade us to their way of thinking. Our job is to question everything to the best of our abilities and to use the resources we have at hand to come to the best logical and sound opinions to keep ourselves and the people around us safe and protected. So, fine, they're spreading propaganda on the internet. They're going under other people's fake names. Now, is that any different than somebody taking the side of the government? And even if these were government or non-government people, if it's just somebody that agreed with Monsanto or agreed with the government and saying, yeah, it's totally fine, should we care that it's a government or not the government posting these things? We should question everything posted on the internet. We should question everything we get in a letter. We should question everything we hear over the telephone, on television, from your friends, from your trusted friends. You should get a second opinion, a third opinion, a fourth opinion. You should research things yourself as much as you can. Obviously, you can't travel the whole world and interview every single person that is involved in a story, but you can do it to your best of abilities, and then even then be skeptical of things. And that's the best you can do, but you can't take things in a blanket statement and say, yes, that's right, because I read it on the internet, it's true. And that's what people used to think. And that's what some people still think. People think that anybody contacting them saying they're the government, saying they're a corporation, automatically trust them and said, oh, everything they say is true. It must be true. It's from an authority. It's from authority. You can't trust authority. That is not, that's a logical fallacy. It's called pleading from authority, I think. Somebody will correct me, but you can't trust just because somebody is in a position of authority. That is the truth. You have to question everything, even things that I'm saying. Yes, I'm not a position of authority. You have to look it up yourself. I provide you with the news stories. You go and look at the news story I find and go look for a story that opposes it. Even if you agree with the story that I'm posting, go look on the other side. What is the other side saying? Maybe it's something that brings up a valid point that you never thought of. Maybe it's being presented in a bad light, or they're omitting information. I've gone over this last show as well about seeking out truth and finding what is true and what is false. Privacy news from the U.S. Phone numbers, data mined, Facebook. Sent in by DC, and a developer that's trying to highlight the dangers of forgetting about personal privacy has unveiled a new service that shows how easy it is for users to have their phone numbers acquired by Facebook visitors. The service, called Evil, sifts through Facebook groups to find posts left by the users that include their phone numbers. It then displays a person's name and all but the last three digits of their phone number on the site. The issue, according to Tom Scott, the tool's creator, is that there are a slew of Facebook groups that are created each day by folks who lose their phones and need their friends' numbers back. Rather than email each person individually, those people create groups where users can simply post their phone number to the group's wall. From there, the group owner can take the numbers and put them into their new phone. Now, I've seen this on my friends as well. They say, I've lost my phone. Please give me your phone number. And what they do is they post it in plain view where anybody can see it. And this could be posted on your friend's wall who has not locked down their privacy. Of course, they could at any time post your phone number if they know it. They could post anything about you that they want. But this is an extra step of precaution. DC says, aptly named web app, Evil. Sorry for not having something more positive to share. Well, this is positive. It's teaching people. teaching people about privacy and what can happen with privacy. Go to this website, take a look, just scrolling by names and phone numbers of people that are just putting out their information onto the web. Well, right now, it's just phone numbers, but what kind of information else can they glean from data mining Facebook without even being an advertiser or third party? Those third party people are paying Facebook, get more information from Facebook than a regular user can. But what can a regular user get? A whole lot of information. And speaking of damaging information you can get from Facebook, firing dispatcher for Facebook drug joke was right, Wisconsin council claims. Privacy news from the U.S. sent in by Minded Version. A city council in Wisconsin defended its decision to fire a police and fire department dispatcher who joked about drug addiction on her Facebook page. Dana Kuchler, a 21-year veteran of West Alias Dispatch Department, joked that she was addicted to Vicodin, Adderall, quality marijuana, MD-2020 grape, and absinthe on the social networking site. She was fired from her job for the remarks and appealed to the arbitrator, claiming the Facebook post was a joke. She pointed out she had written "ha" in it and urine and hair samples tested negative for drugs. The arbitrator said she should be entitled to go back to work after a 30-day suspension. But the city of West Allis complained that was not appropriate. Making stupid jokes on Facebook, where the line between public and private communications is admittedly blurred, called into question that good judgment and common sense of the grievant and her resulting ability to perform her job, the city argued. So this shows a couple of things. The disconnect between your work and your private life is completely blurred. Now, your employer can look into your home activities. They don't have to be your friend. They don't have to be in your house to hear what you're saying. You're posting it for everyone to see on Facebook. And on the flip side, people need to know about what Facebook is revealing to everyone in the world. How they got this information, I don't know. Maybe her Facebook posts are wide available. Maybe she's friends with the people who are investigating her, and she just didn't realize what's going on. What you type into Facebook, assume it is there for the world to see. Even if you've got it locked down, assume that it's there for the world to see. Do not assume that it's private, even if you got it set to just friends. What if those friends retweet it? I know you can't do that on Facebook. If you copy and paste it into your own thing, maybe your friend thought it was funny and joking and they posted on theirs. What can you do about that? It's over. And then they can investigate and say, did you say this on yours? Well, yes, but it was locked down in private. Well, too bad. It's not private anymore. You're fired. So Minded Version says this is why privacy is important, and that's why I wanted to include that news story in the news. Privacy news from Australia. Now, I never thought I'd be agreeing with Stephen Conroy, but I agree with him in this point. Just because somebody makes a lot of bad decisions doesn't mean everything they say is wrong. Even though this guy has really no clue what should be considered on the internet, censored for its own own citizens. But anyway, I go on. Sent in by DC. Australian Minister, Google's privacy policy is creepy. Australia's Communication Minister, Stephen Conroy, isn't happy with Google's latest privacy blunders. He called Google's privacy policy a bit creepy. Specifically, he said that the recent incident where Google was caught collecting private wireless data was the single greatest breach of history of privacy. In the history of privacy, I don't know about that. Google has apologized for collecting Wi-Fi from private households and deleted all the data in its possession. Furthermore, Google claims the entire incident was a mistake. Now, I find that hard to believe. When you go trolling for Wi-Fi and MAC addresses, usually part of the process isn't collecting all the data that goes along with it. Maybe their program did that and they selected a program that just sniffed out everything that went across the wire, and then they selected out the MAC addresses and the names of the open Wi-Fi routers. I don't know. And they just didn't realize it. There are lots of programs out there that do different things. Okay. In 2006, an engineer working on the experimental Wi-Fi project wrote a piece of code that sampled all categories of public broadcast Wi-Fi data. Okay, so it sniffed everything. A year later, when our mobile team started a project to collect basic Wi-Fi network data like SSID information and MAC addresses, using Google Street View cards, they included that code in their software. Oh, okay. Although the project leaders did not want and had no intention of using payload data, Google wrote in a blog post. Now, keep in mind, Google publicly admitted to doing this. Nobody called them out on it. Nobody did an investigation. They admitted to this before anybody even knew about it. They said they did this, and they corrected it immediately before anybody even knew. Stephen Conroy doesn't buy that explanation. It was quite deliberate. Their computer program that collected it was designed to collect that information. Well, if you go by their explanation, it was accidentally included in the new code. Conroy's accusations stem from the fact that Google criticized the Australian government's plan, spirited by Conroy, to apply a nationwide internet filter. They consider that they are the appropriate people to make the decisions about people's privacy data, Conroy said, adding a jabber to it, everyone's favorite target when it comes to privacy issues. Facebook's and Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook, Conroy said, is a corporate giant who is answerable to no one and motivated solely by profit. Well, he's mixing up two things. He's mixing up his censorship decision for the Australian public with privacy. These two things are kind of linked, but not really. It seems like a public jab back at Google for calling out Conroy in his plans for censorship of Australia and taking people's decisions about what sites they visit into the government's hands. I know it's a bit of a puffy piece. He said, she said, kind of, but I thought it was something interesting to include. Copyright news from the U.S. Hollywood considering $20 to $30 movie theater sidesteps, sent in by Mind Inversion. I wanted to highlight this story because it shows what they're trying to push on people as an alternative to copyright infringement on the internet. And you know what? I'm not buying it, and I don't think a lot of other people are buying what they're offering here. Time Warner Cable just pitched the major Hollywood studios a new idea, home theater on demand. It would allow people at home to watch movies just 30 days after they've been released in the theater for $20 to $30. This 30-day home distribution method cuts the general 4-month movie-to-DVD wait time significantly, which means that the movie theaters will have more competition earlier in a film's run. It should be noted, however, that no studio has signed any deals just yet. Such would be extremely bad for theater owners, as their share of ticket sales grows significantly as the film remains in theaters. It'd also be a kick in the nuts to services like Netflix, who's catered to studios' absurd requests in order to gain a pittance of access. So, they're offering movies quicker than before. So, Mind Inversion, who sent in this, I think that their continued failed attempts to grasp reality has broken my brain. Mine as well. So, this follows shortly after gaining the right from the FCC to manipulate the purchased hardware of consumers by turning off the analog output. So, this is not a coincidence in timing here, because they're waiting for that, for the control of people's hardware, their own hardware, to be able to manipulate after selling it, to turn on and off people's hardware and manipulate it so that they could announce this. And they roll out this half-baked idea that people will shell out big money for temporary, high-priced, restricted content. So $20 to $30 for a movie that you could buy for the same price just a little bit later on DVD or Blu-ray, and there's a little bit more leeway in how you can use it. You can actually take that to a friend's house, and this $20 to $30 viewing, I bet you can't even save it on your hard drive. It's like a stream, but who knows how they're going to be offering it. But I don't think this is going to set up a potential alternative to the way people are getting their movies nowadays. I think that's just too high of a price and too restricted and too locked down, because I know you're not going to be able to have this portable, this movie, this $20 to $30 movie, while movies are still in theaters. I know you're not going to be able to transfer it to a handheld device or your computer. It's going to sit in a locked down box where only digital outputs are enabled, because the timing is just too coincidental. It's not really going into a lot of details on how this works. One more story. Net neutrality from the U.S. Congress rebukes FCC on net neutrality rules, sent in by Platon. The Federal Communications Commission's plan to impose net neutrality regulations just became more difficult to pull off. A bipartisan group of politicians on Monday told FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski in no uncertain terms to abandon his plans to impose controversial new rules on broadband providers until the U.S. Congress changes the laws. 74 House Democrats sent Genachowski, an Obama appointee and fellow Democrat, a letter saying his ideas will jeopardize jobs and should not be done without additional direction from Congress. A separate letter from 37 state Republicans, also sent Monday, was more pointed. It accused Genachowski of pushing heavy-handed 19th-century regulations that are inconceivable as well as illegal. This amounts to approximately the last thing that any FCC chairman, at least one concerned with his future political prospects, wanted to happen on his watch. Not only do Monday's letters inject a new element of uncertainty into whether the FCC will try to repurpose analog telephone era rules to target broadband providers, but they also sharply increase the likelihood of the process taking not many months, but many years. Questions about the FCC's legal authority should be decided by Congress itself and not by applying to the Internet a set of onerous rules designed for a different technology and a different situation and a different era. AT&T's Senior Vice President for Legislative Affairs, Jim Ciccone, said Monday. Last month, the Federal Appeals Court unanimously ruled that the FCC's attempt to slap net neutrality regulations on Internet providers in a case that grew out of Comcast throttling BitTorrent transfers was not authorized by Congress. The opinion called FCC's claims flatly inconsistent with the law. Supporters of net neutrality say new internet regulations or laws are necessary to prevent broadband providers from restricting content or prioritizing one type of traffic over another. Broadband providers and many conservatives and free market groups say, on the other hand, say some of the proposed regulations would choke off new innovations, such as setting up walled gardens of pay, and could even require awarding email spam and telemedicine identical priorities. Oh, that's a laugh. For a day or so earlier this month, Genachowski seemed to be wavering and perhaps even favoring an approach that would left broadband services unregulated. But after pressure from liberal advocacy groups, the FCC announced plans on May 6 to resuscitate its net neutrality rules through a legal dodge. Agency lawyers claim stand a better chance of surviving inevitable legal challenge. So they just threw down the glove and said, you're going to have to get more approval before you can enact net neutrality rules. And both the slant they put on net neutrality is so unbelievable that I can understand them not wanting to have more rules from the government, right? Nobody likes rules. But these rules are for the citizens. These are so citizens have more access to the information that they want, so the ISPs can't arbitrarily slow things down and ask for money from the content providers and from the customers for things that they already get. And I've gone over in detail on how net neutrality is essential and needed because of how much control these ISPs have and how much they control areas of the United States and the rest of the world, and in terms of control they have over the citizens, because they have no alternative. So if they set up a pay system where you have to pay for certain things on the internet that used to be completely free and completely full-speed downloads, they complain that the email spam will slow down telemedicine, then really they don't have their servers set up correctly. It's ridiculous to trot that out in this day and age where you think email spam can slow things down. People do not need instant access to their email. It's not like that. There's real time. There's things that are needed in real time take priority already over email. Email is not a real time application. It is not. It does not work like that. And it does not need to be prioritized. There's already things built into routers that you can enact this. Nobody notices that the email is given a lower priority over real-time applications such as voice and data, which is needed to be real-time. And other things are not needed to be real-time. and they mix up this with these the walled gardens that are going to happen, that people are going to, like, the ISPs are going to say, okay, we want more money. How are we going to get more money? By slowing down things and getting people to pay more to get it sped back up to the normal amount. So, you know, there's a bunch of search engines out there. Now, we're going to slow you all down, and if you give us a dollar more a month than the other guys, we'll speed you back up to normal speed. And of course they're going to pay that, because they have to get up back up to speed. Nobody wants to be slower than the competition. And these things are needed so that the ISPs don't, if there wasn't such a monopoly in areas, that people would have a choice of which ISPs to go through, then this wouldn't be such a big deal. People would flock away from the ones that are doing this and slowing down the internet for certain things. Oh, you want the torrent package? Well, you're going to have to pay more. Make sure they're legal torrents. Oh, you want the email package? Well, that's data is data. And that same thing goes for cell phones. I don't understand, at least in the US. In Canada, it's really, really bad, where data plans are cheaper than text plans. And text takes up so little information, but they know they can get away with it. It should be on an even level playing field where voice is almost not used anymore. And it should be, you pay for a bit, you get a bit. Whether it's text, data, voice, or whatever, it's data through the telephone company, and that's what it's going to end up being. Like the cell phone plans, it's going to be like internet. Internet's going to be implemented like that. You want this? Well, you have to pay for this. You want that? You have to pay for that. It's not data anymore. It's artificial separation of data out according to their rules and how much money they can make from it. In Pirate Party news, the PPI wishes good luck to the Czech Pirate Party. On May 28, 2010, the Czech Pirate Party will participate in national... Let me start that again.
Yeah.
Huh. In Pirate Party News, in Pirate Party News, the PPI wishes good luck to the Czech Pirate Party. May 28th, 2010, the Czech Pirate Party will participate, that's a lot of P's, in national election for the first time. This will not only be a big step for the Czech Pirate Party, but also for the pirate movement as a whole, as the electors of yet another country can change the way politics is done by voting pirate. The political program of Czech Pirates will receive more promotion at a conference on Prague on May 22nd, 2010. And there were guests, oh, it did receive, there were guests from Germany, Poland, Slovakia, Bulgaria, and other pirate celebrities such as Amelia Enderstadt, the Swedish Pirate Party MEP, who gave a short talk and answered questions. So good luck to the Czech Pirate Party in your upcoming election. And this one from the Pirate Party of Ireland. This is about IRCOM customers. It says, calling all IRCOM customers, hear ye, hear ye. We're calling on any and all IRCOM customers to contact us and let us know your thoughts on the three strikes deal. We're especially interested in talking to anyone who happens to be contacted by IRCOM on behalf of company's IRMA representatives. Let us know what happens and if they're right or wrong in their accusations. This isn't intended for any kind of witch hunt looking for bad guys using IRCOM to do illicit things. Nor is an exercise in vilifying IRCOM, IRMA, or the companies it represents. It is simply for the purposes of getting a clear picture of the situation undiluted by the thoughts and views of companies with a vested interest in how this deal progresses. So that is something very interesting to watch, how they're going about doing this, and hopefully the Pirate Party of Ireland will be posting information about the customers that are being contacted by IRCOM and the people behind that. Sending them the information. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions, or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them on the front page of the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.